Well, welcome to the DKNA Repos Non-League Show. We're here a little bit later than we said, but we're just too busy having a chat and we forgot to press, I forgot to press go lives, but there we go. So, but anyway, we're here tonight and this one's been set up by Ali, which I'm really pleased about because we've actually got, well, I'll let you introduce it, Ali. Go on. You can introduce it for a change.
So hello everybody, welcome to the Repost Non-League Show with myself and Dave. And joining us today, we've got a couple of wonderful therapists from our lovely non-league community. We've got Hannah coming in from Tower Hamlets, big wave Hannah. And we've also got Stephen coming down to us today to say hello with Morpeth Town. So thanks both for coming in. I've got my physio crew with me today, Dave, so beware. And of course, bigging up the gaffers, we've got John, it's big wave John over there from Enfield, who's in a very, very, very tight situation in the Isthmian at the moment. Back over to you, David.
And of course, I suppose it's unfair because I always introduce, of course, the Enfield Town manager, the living legend. But the real living legend, of course, is the physio, Mr. John Abbott himself. So as these, especially as the governor's actually tuning in. So he hasn't sent me any messages yet, John, but we'll see as we go along.
There'll be some mundane ones, definitely.
Jake Cass will be sending you a few. Come on, Governor. Come and help me out. I want to get fit.
I've been messaging him in Dubai. I've been on WhatsApp talking to him today. So, he knows that I'm keeping an eye on him.
Is he back out there again?
Yeah.
Oh, what for some on it, eh? Who wants to go there? And of course, I mean, I suppose the first question you've got to ask, really, and it's a fun question, and as James Beardwell says, it's a bit of banter, but what's it like, Hannah, working with the rogue that is Justin? Huh? Has he calmed down a bit? Has he since, as the older he gets?
Yes. we're at a bit of a transition at the moment at Tower Hamlets. On social media, you would have seen Justin's actually left us.
Has he?
Yes.
I didn't see that. No, I didn't.
No. So Kears, who came in as player manager, he has now taken over. And Connor French, who was playing with us at the beginning of the season, has now joined as assistant. And so it's been an interesting little period of transition, I guess you could say. But no, I mean, working with Justin, I think he's a fantastic gaffer. And I've learned a lot from him in terms of football, and you know, hopefully we can now see through what we was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. I've got to say, I've not met a more passionate or involved manager than Justin Gardner. I've got to say that I've been in the game a very long time, and honestly, he is top notch. So good luck, Justin, wherever you go next. I'm always bigging you up. You know that, even though the Beatty stuff, we'll let that go for the time being. Now.
So I suppose, I mean, majority of the questions, and I suppose we will be led by Ali like tonight, but I'd just be really interested, you know, I see a lot of the times, you know, people tweeting Ali, and which is mainly, and, you know, and the nutter that is Ems, you know, being sort of like tweeted quite regularly, and, you know, I follow them, you know, and both on Twitter, and they sort of constantly getting this sort of messages. Do you know a physio that can come down and help us, or a therapist that can come down and help us? So how, for you guys and ladies that are doing the job, would you say that it's the most important job, you know, in the club? And how hard is it these days to get a really sort of professional like you four are, you know, physiotherapists, you know, to actually go into clubs? Stephen?
Oh, straight under the bus, am I? no, definitely not the most important person at the club. I think that's the chairman, isn't it? It's just, I think leadership starts at the top. We've seen that in the BBC, like it starts at the top and works its way down, hopefully. But I think it's hard. I think the broader thing in football, and I think it's getting better now, that it's starting to get more appreciated. I see a lot of adverts where they're asking for physio sports therapists, and then they'll tag at the bottom expenses available or whatever, and it's like, well, you could expect to get someone who plays football, but on a weekend, they only play football on a weekend. Through the week, they're actually doing their job. You could expect them to want to turn up for the love of the game. But for someone who's a therapist, you want them to come to work and actually be a therapist. So it's their job. So you should be, it should be an expectation that they're going to get paid at the rate of their job. And I think going back even kind of I've been in non-league football now for probably getting on towards 20 years. And I think you'd speak to a chairman and you'd be getting offered like 20, 30 quid a week. And they'd want you in 3 days a week for training, game. They want you to bring your own kit. They'd want you to, you know, give as much commitment as possible, maybe see players on the side. And then and they're offering absolutely nothing. And you'd have players on maybe 10 times as much. But I think that's getting different or changing. I think things that are helping will be things like leagues starting to have licensing requirements. I've done a stint at Berwick Rangers in Scotland, and the Scottish FA had a licensing requirement and that a therapist had to be a certain level. And I think that's kind of, I know it is like that in professional football, but I think even the National League system, National League North, Northern Premier Leagues are starting to look at what kind of level somebody should be and have an actual standard. And I think that's going to be the big thing that'll kind of, you'd hope, push its way down. Long answer that one, sorry.
John?
No, I'm the same, Steve, really. I mean, I think, you know, our chairman, Paul, I mean, you know well, and Andy Lees, the gaffer, I mean, they are, you know, I get treated with nothing but utter respect. I even to the stage where I have a club credit card, so when it comes to sort of reordering stock and so on and so forth, there's never a boo-hoo at the chairman. It's just straight away, you know, you need it for games. You know, there is a recognition that in the men's game, you know, that there is a requirement to have a decent size, you know, sort of store of kit, you know, from K-tape, creative bandage, EAB, you know, you name it, you know, down to your sort of cold and hot spray, and as the gaffer would say, and your wet sponge in your bucket. But no, I think in essence, you know, we are cheated well. But I think, as Steve said, that there is new legislation coming in next season around, in particular around the sort of Isthmian League, around what qualifications people have, how many hours a day they're, how many hours a week they're spending doing the job. So I think that the legislation is getting tighter. But I think, as Steve alluded to right at the beginning, was the fact that, you know, the pay the pittance, how you're going to get those qualified people and sort of still expect them to get them on a shoestring. So, you know, I think it's vitally important that, you know, communication goes up and down.
Hannah?
No, I don't think that we're the most important person. But I mean, I think that without us, you have to have us in order to be that balance in the changing room as well. You have to be there in not just a physio respect, in more of a welfare, allow that other person that the players can check in with, and then perhaps be that diplomatic person. I still think it's a very important role. But yeah, I think that everyone has their right position. But it's like, I don't think that I could go into management at that level, as much as I love the game. But I got back into it because I love football. Like what you were saying earlier, like, you know, you get some people that are doing it because it is their job. But I have a different job, my full-time job. And then this is I love football. I love being involved. I love being behind the scenes. And it's why I do it.
I mean, I know Ali will probably say exactly the same, and I'll hope she can answer in a second.
I'm the most important person at all my clubs. I'm going to put it on the line.
Well, I was just going to say, for
me and the kit man.
would somebody like, and I'm just going to pick one name out of the hat, and he's going to be loads of others, but people like, if he was sitting here as a guest number, you know, guest number six on here, or person number six on this podcast here tonight, and that was Christian Eriksen, and we asked the same question of Christian Eriksen, would he answer the same thing, that you guys are not the most important?
I'd say for him on that eventful day, I think his teammates were really important. I think they did the first bit first. I mean, I'm a big advocate for the viewpoint that it's everyone's responsibility to keep everyone safe. And ultimately on the pitch, I had it on the weekend, pitch side, my players will see a problem before I see it because they're very much closer. It's about us all sort of appreciating where we're all coming from. And I think that pitches are vital to what we do. But we are part of the cog of the machine of football. If we don't get listened to by a manager, then there's a problem. If a player won't follow our advice, you know, if we're not respected, if we all have to be a part of that little cog of football. I mean, ultimately, I like to think I'm important. I don't think I am that important when it comes down to it. But my best day is somebody's worst day, isn't it, in football? That's what I always think anyway, personally, that when I'm shining my brightest, it's because somebody's had a really bad day. I don't like to be involved in football. I want to be quiet and sitting and doing nothing all day, if I'm being honest, David. I like being bored because it means all the boys are safe. I'm being horrible about it, you know. Yeah. It's a hard one, isn't it? Because I must say, I think we're losing physios in droves at the minute. I mean, guys, open as you guys, we are losing so many good therapists. Physiotherapists have been in there for a long time. You know, I think it's going to be very hard to attract us guys into the league. Have we got any ideas how to get them back in or how to retain people? You know, it's a very hard. I know they're going to change the standards soon, but it's very hard to get a physio to get to a club at the moment, isn't it? I mean, I can't get one for a lot of money for some clubs, even with a lot of money, frankly.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot more kind of, I don't know if it's in your area or your leagues, I suppose the population, there's a lot more down your way, but there doesn't seem to be as much kind of moving around. I think a lot of therapists at our level up here tend to just join a club, and I don't think maybe so much come with a manager or whatever, whereas I think it seems to be a lot. I mean, our league's predominantly Manchester, Liverpool, and there seems to be a lot more to and thrown where they kind of go on around Robin, go around with the manager, like they do in professional football, I suppose, where the manager will take his full backroom staff, whereas I think in our league, or definitely in the Northeast, basically the therapist has probably been there for a long time, and managers will come and go, and it'll probably be the same therapist. It's changing maybe a little bit, but I think predominantly that's kind of how it works up here anyway.
I mean, for me, one of the things I've always wanted to see, and I know me and Ali have had the conversation before on a show and so forth, I'm still surprised that, you know, the leagues that everybody's in, that, you know, I mean, maybe the Southern League and the, you know, and the Northern Prem and you know, in the Southern League, that they don't actually get these people, you guys, together. So, you know, I know you can't all travel into one area because it'll be very, very difficult, but it gets to a situation where you could have sort of two or three meetings or whatever else so many times a year, where all you sort of physiotherapists and physios can all get together and actually have that sort of conversation and learn from each other. And almost, you know, and if there's anybody there that's an inspiring one as well, could be there as well, that you could then, you know, almost like not a training session, but something where you just put all your heads together and help out, and just to sort of like promote the job a little bit more.
It's a cracking idea. I think I can't really go into it because it's very fresh at the minute. We've had a problem with physio in a league that I'm in, and he's had no support with a very bad situation. And I think it was a bit eye-opening to go, oh, actually, who do I go to when I have a problem? You know, who do I call when something terrible's happened? And, you know, because the FA hasn't really got a physio lead to go to say, oh, I had this problem, or there's no safeguarding for physios, or there's no, I mean, I'll open up the other guys, so maybe Hannah can help me out, or John, and what they would do, because honestly, I think it's screaming out for more support networks in football. Maybe do like the refs and get a support network on Twitter. Who knows? Not quite as aggressive, I hope.
But no, I think you're right, Ali. Oh, sorry.
No, go on, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, I think I'm sort of slightly more blessed than a lot, because my day job is I'm a divisional director in the NHS, and as a consequence, I have a whole rafter of physios that work. So, you know, if we exchange things with, you know, like a particular person's got a particular injury that's not getting any better, it's not getting any worse, and it's that rehabilitation, pre-rehabilitation, you know, sort of type conversations that I can have with sort of really current, bright young things, as well as very seasoned people. So I think what Dave alludes to, and what you've alluded to, Ali, is the right thing to do. I think, you know, we should have some kind of forum, even if it's only a forum within each of our respective leagues, that then feed into a more sort of, you know, sort of global sort of meeting. I think it would be really, really useful, because it's not just that, it's ideas. You know, I mean, it's the old argument, activation versus, you know, sports massage. You know, a lot of people believe, oh no, I'm not doing massage. Only that's not for you. Activation is what it's all about. And you know, I have this conversation with colleagues, you know, quite a bit. Is it activation? Is it you know, sports massage? So you know, there's a lot of varying views, and I think just to have a forum for that, and it would benefit a lot of people, especially old people like me.
I'll make a mental note.
Hannah?
My day job is I'm a PE teacher in the department of one. And so I find it very similar, the two roles. Not having that support network does get difficult. Mm. Even just to bounce ideas off of just day to day or how you deal with a separate situation. I think it would be great. There was a rowing competition I did recently at school, and they just set up a WhatsApp group, but then it's like, would people actually want to join it? But even things like doing a borough network meeting where we all turn up once every X, Y, and Z, then we could, then that would be a prime opportunity to do the exact same, really. Mm.
Stephen, would you like to see Mark Harris bring that in up in the Northern Prep?
Well, me and Ali are in a WhatsApp group where there's 50 therapists in that. And I think that works quite well every now and again. There'll be a big subject, and sometimes it goes quiet for weeks and then it'll absolutely flare up, something will happen. I've considered a couple of times having and spoke to a few therapists as I go around the you know, playing different teams and stuff about maybe having like an email group or something where we can share ideas and something like that. But I think there's also a little, they're the enemy as well in a way. Like some teams I just wouldn't even speak to. Do you know what I mean? So you've got to try and rise above that and be a bit more professional. And I certainly do. I've been sent off a few times, to be fair.
You haven't, Stephen. What did you get sent off? I'm going to be nosy now. It's very rare you get a physio being sent off. It's a big thing this day.
I know. I was going through it by the time. I had two years ago, I was sent off twice. Mm. And I ended up with a stadium ban for one of them. Started a bit of a riot, to be honest.
Now, am I right saying, though, on that, I thought you couldn't get sent off?
Certainly can, David. You don't like to publicise it.
No, basically, you can, but only if the other team's therapist accepts responsibility for both teams.
Right, okay. I thought it was the manager that got sent off for you.
No, it also depends on the level.
Right.
So, yeah, you can. So there was one... To be honest, the first ban came from, he wanted to send us off. I pointed that out to him. He didn't realise it wasn't the case, and he was like, oh, you're right, I can't. So I got a yellow and then got reported, basically. And then the second one, I just got sent off. It was just, I think that he must have been a better referee and realised that I actually... I've kind of rose above that now, I hope, and grown up a bit. But I think if you've got to, we've got to open up to like other, I think the only times we really speak to other therapists is when you're doing emergency action plans at the start of games, if something's happened and you've ended up helping out with one of their players or whatever, and then if you come across each other on an ITMIF or an APMIF, and I think because you have to go on them every 3 years, you generally see the same. Like I kind of speak, like in that WhatsApp group I was mentioning before, there's probably about 10 or 15 people who I've seen on the ITMIF course 3 or 4 times. So you kind of meet people that way, but there definitely needs to be something, even maybe a union or something. I know there's a football medicine FMPA thing that's a bit of a union for therapists. Especially in professional football, maybe there needs to be something for non-league as well, just to share ideas. I know, you know, if there's loads of times, doesn't happen so often now at our level, but it used to happen a lot where, you know, the away team would rock up and then be like, oh, do you mind looking after our lad tonight? Because our physio couldn't make it or whatever. And you're like, I didn't really want to get into your dressing room and treat your lads because you're the enemy. Like, if one of yous goes down, I'm telling your manager you need to get changed. If you're
Strikers finished.
Precaution. So you need to rise above that, I suppose.
I mean, with it though, I mean, I'd be very, very interested how. Two questions. One, how did you guys get into the field in the first place? But also as well, I see sort of loads of jobs just recently, not just sort of like at our level, but I'm seeing jobs at places like Watford and Luton and places like this where they're advertising now for, you know, like a first team physio or something to do with that sort of, in that sort of realm. Would that be something that if you guys saw that you would look at that and think, oh, do you know what? Doing that full time would be something I'd like to do, and say like Hannah, maybe giving up the teaching or giving up the NHS, John, or you know whatever. Sorry, Steve, I didn't catch what you do normally, but you know, would you sort of be tempted to go into something like that?
Nothing.
Oh, in the future.
I've done it before, but I actually work for Mort with full time. We've run an academy. Like a post 16 education, so we've got 16-19 year olds that I look after through the day, and then the bigger kids come in on the night. So I enjoy that side of it. I've worked in professional football, and I did enjoy being, I suppose, a smaller cog in a multidisciplinary team, but I like the responsibility of the non-league stuff. And to be honest, the money is a big thing, because I think it's awful in professional football. I was literally making more money by working in gyms, doing my own little bits on the side, than I would be working in football. I mean, if you get in the Premier League now, there's minimum kind of rates and stuff, so it can get, you know, you can, there's a lot of money to be made in the Premier League and the Championship. But I think you can be in a League One club or a League Two club, you could end up being a one-man band looking after multi-million pound players and be earning like not even, well, but when you calculate the real hours that you would put in, it wouldn't be minimum wage. And I think that is the big reason why people don't go for it, because it's just, for me, so I seen one a few years ago where it was a head of sports science and medicine job, and it was a London, South London club. They were in the Championship at the time, and they were asking for a master's, a degree, a UEFA B license, 2 years elite, 2 years elite worth of experience, and it was like 22 grand. And it was in London. I was saying, well, you're not, there's people at McDonald's like getting paid. Like, how could you? You couldn't even afford to travel into London, let alone live there, work there. And let's be honest, it's professional football, or even non-league football. If it says that you're getting paid for 2 or 3 hours, we know you can triple that with the amount of time that you're actually spending on the role. Mm. So for me, it's just, nah, not for me.
I'm with you, Stephen. It's not something. I think because, you know, at the club I'm at, you know, Enfield, you know, it's a group of boys you get to sort of spend time bond with. And because of the fact that you're, you know, sort of having regular contact, you know, if you like take COVID, for instance, I'm sure that you were sort of patient, you were a player's advocate, you know, during that. I mean, I know that I would bring every single one of the squad during COVID at least, you know, sort of once a week, just for that health and well-being that sort of Hannah was mentioning earlier. I think also as well, you know, I think the more the emphasis on you as an individual to sort of perform 7 days a week, you know, you can't have an off day, or, you know, you can't have a day when you want to say, I want some downtime now, you know, because although I love football to bits, you know, there are days when I just want to distance myself and sort of have some time to yourself. And I think you're absolutely right. If you go to that level, you're eating, sleeping, drinking, sort of everyday football. So I wouldn't, not for me.
But Hannah, you'd be tempted?
Yeah.
Don't do it.
When I did my work experience when I was like 16, I started off at Dagenham Bridge. I worked my way up a bit. Stayed there for a good few years, and I was under John Steele and Johnny Gowans, and you know, they sort of learned everything from them. And then, yeah, got into teaching. The dream was always to go into physio after my teaching career, had come to an end. No one likes an old PE teacher, but you can be of an age and still be running about on a pitch. So I wanted to teach for a good few years and then go off, but I didn't want to do it here. I saw, what was her, who was the Chelsea Fizz? Eva.
Yeah.
Oh, I bloody love Eva.
I changed my mind about it here, and I thought, you know what?
Yeah.
I want to. There's going to be a point in my life when I want to go to the States and I want to go and try over there. You know, my godfather is a female soccer league coach, and it would be so much easier over there, I feel. But to do it here, obviously, that would be incredible. I'm not going to lie and say that would be a dream. Would it be a lot of work? Yes. But like what we're talking about, that would be a complete change of career again. And it would be full time, not just for the love of the game. Like when Justin left, we spoke about my role still at the club. And I said, no, I've built a relationship with the players. I'm going to see this through. And you know, it's got to be tough to make that decision in the middle of a season. And I said, no, we've got to keep some consistency now. And so when we said that me and Keirs were going to stay on, that I felt like that's what the team needed.
Mm.
So.
I mean, also as well, we've sort of like, I suppose most people would call it the physio job in the clubs. I don't know if it's me, but since I've been involved in non-league football, I don't know, 13 years, it seems to have moved on astronomically. I mean, do you know what I mean? You know, I still remember when I first started doing it, that, you know, doing tannoys and whatever else for Harlow and other places, you never, ever saw a young lady or an older lady running onto the pitch as a physio. You never saw a guy running onto the pitch unless he had the magic sponge in a bucket.
From the age of about 10, it was my dream.
Mm.
I always wanted to be in football. I loved football. I knew that's what I was going to do. I didn't care. I did, and even though it wasn't even Eva wasn't around then, right? And I knew that's what I wanted.
But you know what I'm trying to say? It's now gone, like, even at our level. I don't know if you'd say that, Steve and John and the girls, but it really has gone sort of almost. I don't even go as far as say what maybe even what the Premier League was 10, 12 years ago. Maybe, you know, we're sort of catching up very, very quickly. I know you haven't necessarily got all the Fandango stuff in the back, you know, like hospital beds and stuff like that in the stadiums. But if you know what I'm saying, just for the physio, I mean, I see Ali sometimes on some of the pictures, you know, she actually posts and, you know, she's got a car that you wouldn't even get another per passenger in, you know, where there's so many bags in there and stuff like that. It just seems to have moved on to another level, your job. And I find it for you guys very, very insulting when people say, well, could you just pop down the road and be a physio for us, but there's no money in it. So where do you see the job role now from when you first started doing the physio work to where we are now? Has it increased the amount of level, or am I just imagining things?
I think you're very right. I think football's changed a lot, hasn't it? I think from being like jumpers for goalposts and just getting on with it to being players really care about their bodies, they care about performance. Managers film games now, they have analysts, and a physiotherapist or therapist forms part of that, as in like sort of keeping your players in top nick, keeping their well-being at the top front of it, giving sure their injuries that can come through. You know, I think it's football's changing a lot. I think it's becoming even at our level. I mean, obviously I'm in the Essex senior, but even at our level, you know, the games are getting filmed. You know, people are having analytics done. They're wearing the vest to see what their body rates are doing, how many miles they're running. I think performance has become a big thing in football now, and I think the best way of ensuring performance from being big headed is to invest in your medical team. Well, medical team, me or one of us. Sounds better when I say medical team. Medical team of one. But I think ultimately myself, I've been doing this about 15 seasons now. I think when I first started the movement, maybe one other girl with Donna at Fisher when I did it. And now it's one of the mills to see young ladies doing the game. I think it's fantastic. I think it's about role models, it's about seeing yourself doing things. I mean, remember when I first saw Dr. Eva run on and I went, oh, this is it. This is our moment now to see if we can grow and develop. I think it's literally about us role modelling. For, I mean, you see kids at games seeing us running on, go, oh, I could do that. You know, I could be a physio at a game. I've got a 17-year-old doing work with me right now. And she'll be the next one of us when I'm gone and when I'm retired in the next few years. She's trying to still. I know I'm trying, Dave. It's really hard.
Right, you're about 23. Yeah.
I know I'm trying for about 3 seasons, but these kids now have more awareness of what football physio is. I mean, they see the Ericsons and say, "Oh, physio, what they do is doctors." I think it's only going to grow and develop from here, really. Mm. Same way that our coaches are. I think we're really a golden era for the change of non-league football, being just a load of guys drinking beer after games, having a fag at half time and chilling out. Actually, no, this is different now. It's more elite than it's ever been. Mm. We're a part of that. I'll stop rubbing it on now. My own job. Have it, man.
John, I mean, do you feel it's changed a lot in the last sort of 10, 12 years?
Oh, absolutely, Dave. I mean, I started off sort of looking after sort of Enfield Town ladies in Middlesex representative side. And, you know, I was invited along one day by the gaffer, but you know, to come and fill in while the physio at the time was on holiday. But I think, you know, everything's changed. I mean, you'd have one type of tape originally. Now there's so many different types of tape. There's so many methodologies of tape, and you know, no one had heard of turf toe three, 4, 5, 6 years ago. Now it's common, and you know, people are sort of expecting different strappings for this, different strappings for that. And I think, you know, it's. And I don't know if what the guys think, but, you know, there is a lot still, you know, evolutionally to learn week in, week out. You know, you'll come across something different, you know, and I think that's harping back to sort of Ali and Stephen's bit about having the network. I think, you know, it would be quite useful to have that opportunity because it has changed. I mean, you know, I started off with a really small bag. Now I go to games with two really big bags and, you know, two pouches. You know, so I think equipment-wise has changed, if nothing else.
Mm. Stephen?
Yeah, I think Ali made a good point right at the end there about the even the coaches. Like, if you look at our level, I think maybe 10 years ago, it would have been the gaffer would have been an ex-player at that level who'd kind of, he was probably the club captain, retired, chairman wanted to stay around, became the manager. Whereas now you've got coaches with like pro licenses and A licenses and B licenses who have been around, got thousands of hours of experience, have maybe been working in an academy through the day, and then on a night they go and coach a senior team. And I think that kind of filters down. And then again, the other point about the social media, I mean, we've got a media team that's got about 5 members in, mm-hmm. Someone films the game. We've got GPS with everyone at the club, all of our academy players wear GPS. It's just like, and then, you know, you go back to when I started, it was literally about handed a first aid kit. And I got asked to come along because I was in my first year at uni. My best mate was the captain, and he'd been asked if he knew anyone who could do a bit of first aid, and that was it. And it was just basically you were doing ropes, maybe a strapping, guessing how to put a strapping on, learning on the job. And now, like, even me, I know Ali's always got students with her and interns and stuff. I think I've got 6, there's 2 with our first team, and then we've got 6 with our academy. And I think that's important that people who are in roles try to get help with interns, try to get work experience, because that's what I was doing. I've had to start a day where I've literally had the conversation of you can't get enough experience. You need to learn on the job, even if it's just watching. Don't expect to get paid all the time. Just, you know, because I had one girl who, she had to do, I know I'm going completely off on a tangent here, but it's an example. She had to do 25 hours work experience for a degree, and it got to the 25th hour and she was like, right, well, I've done the hours now, I'm going to stop. And then she was like, well, I play netball on a weekend. I was like, well, you're not planning on being a netballer, are you? And she was like, I know, but it's good for me mental health. And I was like, right, okay, fair enough. That's just an example, you know. She just decided it wasn't fair. And I think, well, you're doing a degree in sports science or sports therapy. You've done your hours and it's just like a tick in the box and you're not going to continue that on. I can't see how you're really going to kick on. Your CV's not going to look great. I can't even remember the original question, to be honest. I know I've gone off on a total tangent there, but I just think the whole standards, non-league clubs are having multidisciplinary teams even. And I think it's just all coming along because, and even I think a lot of people were turned off professional football because of the ridiculous finances involved and people want the non-league games. And then they bring with them an expectation of a professional outlook. And I think clubs are looking to try to be more professional, whether that's with streaming games or whatever, having academies. And I think non-league clubs, if you go to France and Spain, whatever, you won't find teams in Division 7 and Division 8 where you've got a player on a grand a week and they've got five people in the medical staff. It just won't happen. Whereas I think in England and in the UK, there's that love of the game runs so deep that even non-league football will have that kind of, that level of professionalism. I think it's only going to increase, I think.
Well, we've had two messages coming. One of them's a thank you. He's asked me to read it. It's James Carpenter. He said, can I just give a massive thanks to everyone at Horsham FC for everything from everyone at Herne Bay FC for their collection for the injured Bay forward. And I'm going to get his name. Was it Kimani Thomas? Between the two clubs, bucket collection in excess of £1,100 has been raised, which will help Kiami in his recovery from a broken leg sustained at the recent Isthmian League game played between the two clubs. Top club, top people at Horsham, thank you. And then I've had a Miranda Fabricio has come in, and not necessarily the subject that we're talking about tonight, but... he says, best regards to all of you. I like this programme and what is being talked about. I have a question. What do I need to do to be a professional referee here in the UK? I need someone to help me, guide me. Thank you so much. Well, if you're still listening, Miranda, you just need to contact your local FA and they will put you in the right direction. You can get them on Twitter, Essex FA, Hertfordshire FA, et cetera, et cetera. And they will literally put you in charge, well, put you in... process of getting hold of somebody that'll be able to help you, especially going on the courses that all the FAs actually hold on a regular basis. So make sure you do that, because again, refereeing, of course, is another thing that is very rare in this country with people wanting to do it. One question I've got to ask, because it's a question that I've seen come up on a group that I'm on Facebook, and it comes up quite regularly. And I've seen it on Sky TV, the same question comes up. I've seen it on BBC where the same question comes up. And I can talk about it tonight because Keith's not on here, because Keith don't like talking about it. But women's football. And basically the question that I've got to ask is, why is it that the ladies that play football, and I'm a massive ladies football fan before we go on, why is it that a lot of the professional ladies teams, their players suffer really regularly with literally a ACL injury? Why do they suffer more with ACL injuries than what the men do? I mean, I've seen some sort of things saying it's around menstrual cycles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all this sort of stuff, and people put on there. But I'd be very interested from your point of view, why you feel there seems to be more with the likes of, especially the club that I support, in the likes of Beth Mead and Vivian Wiedemar, you know, both had ACL injuries within the space of a week of each other. And it seems to be regular where you see some of the ladies there have about three or four ACL injuries, you know, throughout their career. Is there a reason for it, or is it just being unlucky? I mean,
it's currently an emerging field. So the women footballers have not had much research done as to their injury patterns. Lots in men's football, not so much in women's.
Funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny, isn't it? A lot of medical research doesn't look at it. So essentially, I think it's multifactorial. One is around sort of our hormone levels in our bodies as females. It fluctuates throughout the month, and there's a pattern towards training and how we're loading women in training. Again, a lot of coaches don't know how to load a woman when they're training. I wouldn't know. I've never learned it at university either, in fairness. But actually, the Essex FA did a really good piece on it. I'll try and dig it out and put it onto my Twitter later on. But also, they think that the equipment women use is different. So going down to the football boots are designed for men, not for women. And our hips are slightly different in women. So they feel that may also be causation effect. They're currently looking into it, because it is a massive... what I would say is that, David, if it's happening in the men's game, it would have been dealt with by now. I'll put it that way, because people would have invested sports science-wise into looking into why it's happening. I think it's being addressed now and being looked into, but there's a lot of research done around why women are doing injuries like this. It's a big problem, really, actually. Think of our top-class elite level women are having these really sort of career ending potentially injuries. It's madness, really, isn't it? I don't know how you guys think about that, but
Stephen?
Well, like Ali says, it's multifactorial. I mean, talk about the Q angle of the hips and stuff like that. Menstrual cycle. I think it depends on what level you're probably looking at, but I think if you look at the men's game, the level of strength and conditioning kind of support they'll have is probably a lot more than the women's game will have. Mm. Even, you know, there's I don't think there's many women's teams that are full-time. The ones that are, I think, get looked after really well. But from a budget-wise, I know for a fact there's a couple of clubs our way where their medical staff and stuff, they're basically they usually share facilities with men's academies rather than with the men's first team, and they don't have that level of, you know, they just won't have the time. Whereas a woman's full-time program, even women that are full-time, it's still almost a part. You could have a job through the day, but they train every night of the week. Whereas men, because of the finance in the sport, that is all they're doing.
And it's strange though, Stephen, because I mean the two that I've just mentioned there, you know, in Viv and Beth, of course they're at Arsenal, they're using all those sort of same facilities as what the men are using, because you often see
They weren't when they were 20 though, were they?
I think that's
a big thing, because I think the men have generally coming from either academies, professional football, they've been doing all those strength and conditioning programs from 17, 18, 19s. You look at the Beth Meads, Lucy Bronze, Steph Hortons and all them, even at 21, 22, they were still part-time. Mm. And it's only kind of, you look at the level of intensity in the women's game, how much that's increased compared to the men's game, really, in the last 10 years. It's an exponential increase in terms of intensity, professionalism, the volume of games and training a lot more. And I think that is probably all a little bit of a factor as well. They're doing a lot more than they've previously done before.
John, I mean, you've been involved in a women's game, you said there. I know it's Enfield Ladies, but still been involved with the ladies' game. I mean, anything from your side?
I think the guys have summed it up perfectly. I mean, I think the strength and conditioning and the, you know, the exposure to football and how many times a week the, you know, the ladies are playing. Unless you are sort of at a top flight club from a very young age or an academy, you're not, as Stephen says, you're not getting that support, you're not getting that guidance. There is, I think, a great deal also to do with boots, because as Ali alluded to, they're not, you know, some manufacturers now are starting to manufacture ladies' boots, but they never used to. So, you know, ladies would have to wear, you know, the boot that an average sort of male footballer would wear. And also, you know, sort of hormonal changes and, you know, sort of, menstrual cycles does play a massive role too. I mean, I know that, you know, you can anecdotally, I mean, and I'm a big advocate of the ladies game and still do sort of the odd ladies game on a Sunday for our ladies now. You know, you do notice that with them, that sort of the mood changes and so on and so forth, you know, not to ask questions, you know, because, you know, as it stands, you know, people don't like to talk about it. People don't like to talk about potential injuries and so on and so forth. You know, it's like a taboo subject. So, you know, I don't think I've got a lot to add other than Stephen Elliott done.
So with that sort of injury, because the other thing that baffles me is you used to see somebody have an ACL injury before and they'd be plastered and then they'd have the knee brace on for a period of time and et cetera, et cetera. But I've seen pictures and I say I follow the ladies' game a lot, you know, but I've seen pictures of people like Beth Mead, especially Beth Mead, where they're talking about her missing the World Cup in sort of like, I don't know what, 3, 4, 5 months time. But you see her in sort of like pictures, no knee brace on, there's no plaster cast on, no nothing like that whatsoever on her. And she seems to be walking around, going to award ceremonies here, award ceremonies there, training with people like, with the guys too. So what is the recovery for something like that? So if they've had those injuries that are that serious, what sort of recovery time? And it's going to sound a silly question to ask, but does a lady's body recover quicker than a men's body? Because I mean, you look at it and sometimes when you see men do an ACL, they're out for 12 months, you know, 10 to 12 months. But already when you see the likes of Beth and Vivian, they're already sort of walking around, no crutches, no nothing.
They're just harder than us.
If you don't want to say it, David, just built different. What do you reckon, Hannah? Just built different. I think a lot of the way around ASOS, we manage them now, is changing a lot, David, around how we manage them, but the importance of movement, of loading appropriately, obviously, with the injury and the patient that's been used. But essentially, I think the old days of casting an ACL are well and truly gone. I've not seen one of them for donkey's years, frankly. And even I think now the bracing is kind of coming off a little bit, as long as they're not moving too much, they're normally okay. But the key thing is, I'm very biased as a physiotherapist, but the key thing is to move and load something as soon as you can and as appropriately as you can, and to have a tailored treatment to that person rather than going on a protocol. But that's the importance of having a physio to back you up, isn't it? Have someone to watch you at each stage and safely move you on to each stage of your rehab. There's a movement now towards no surgery for ACLs, but I don't know how I feel about that quite yet. I'm still a little bit on the knife edge if I like it or not. But I've seen a couple of sort of conservatively managed ACLs that have done really well, no surgery, and got back playing. A whole new ball field for medical science, I think, with where we're progressing on.
So I mean, as sort of, you know, physios and therapists and stuff, you're in a game or you're in training, how much now compared to years ago does the manager or one of the coaches take notice of what you say? And what I mean by that is, if you turn around and say, I'm just putting some kind of context. I mean, you know, say for instance, I don't know, you've got a massive game at the end of the season, say, and it's a difference between you being in the playoffs or getting promoted. Say for instance, I don't know, you're playing Averley last game of the season, for instance, and all of a sudden, you know, you need 3 points to get into those playoffs, and all of a sudden, the likes of, you know, Mr. Cunnington and Jake Cass and Wiley all go down with injuries, you know, and you go to, you know, Andy, or you go to your manager, and it's like, well, they can't play. There's just no way they can play. How much now do they take notice of what you say compared to maybe years ago?
I can only talk personally, then. I mean, with the gaffer, you know, with Andy, you know, we'll have a conversation, and he'll say, you know, how long do you think? And I'll tell him what I think. I'll say, obviously, we'll do everything we possibly can. But, you know, if I say the players don't play, I mean, he is very respectful of my decision. And I think you're absolutely right. You go back 5-10 years ago, people would be given cortisone injections or steroid injections, and they'll be playing that game. But I like to think now that there's been an improvement in that thought process, but I know that I can talk personally, but I do get listened to.
And by the way, hopefully we're in the playoffs before we play Averley, but that's not the point. Stephen?
I can only talk from experience, really. I've always kind of been kind of part of that management decision, in terms of, I wouldn't say I'm helping pick the players, but I'm around when they're having that kind of conversation. And it's just a bit of a team effort in terms of where they are. I mean, I'll often say to a player, if the game was at Wembley, would you be available? And that kind of
exactly what I say to him.
I think you have to, because ultimately you are there to look after players' safeguarding and stuff, but you're part of the performance of the team. And I think the best way for a team to perform is to have its best players on the pitch as often as possible. So I think you'd be mad to try to pretend that you don't at times take a little bit of a risk with players. I think it's just a case of, if it's something that you're going to probably make it worse, then you're probably going to err on the side of caution. If it's something where it's a little bit of pain, but you can probably get through it, it's a conversation with the player. But I think you have to kind of put the responsibility on the player a little bit, almost let them make the decision. I think you have to, there's been a couple of times when I've kind of given it the, well, on your head, Bate, because I don't think you should play. But generally speaking, it's just a conversation. And I think maybe, again, probably going back to what we spoke about at the start, I think when you had basically somebody who's a first aider and they're just there to help out making a decision, the manager's probably not going to listen to them so much. I think when you've got someone who's really qualified, really experienced, it's their job, and you're having a mature conversation with the coach about the risks and rewards of doing it. I don't think there's many managers who are really going to want players playing who aren't fit to play. I don't think that would really happen that often. Yeah, that's probably my answer. It's normally the chairman who's wanting players to be pushed. Oh, he's my best player. I need him playing.
Hannah?
I'm lucky that I've always had pretty great relationships with my managers. And so they've always listened. Maybe not on the first time, but the second time, definitely. If we didn't have, like what we were saying, the very first one was the topic that we were talking about.
Yeah.
For us not to be there and not to have that say, that's our level of importance. We are the ones that should be the ones that go yay or nay. Mm. And, because at the end of the day, we could still be, these players are hoping to move on from us at some point. And, it could be make or break. If they get injured further, that's their career on the line. And I'm not going to push anyone if I don't think that they're going to get, if I'm going to get their optimum out of them on that particular day. Mm. And if management didn't listen, I'm very confident to tell them that they should be listening.
Well, I like Hannah so much.
She seems to be a very confident young lady, and yeah, very confident. But I mean, she's not going to be the nicest sort of question to ask, but is there sometimes when someone does play the player that you've told them not to? Have you ever had that in that sort of in your time, and then they do break down and you just sort of look, you almost look at the governor and go,
I've not had that experience.
I've had it a few times. They won't lie. And you know what? I don't even want to do that. I told you so. Because ultimately, I feel bad for the player. Because ultimately, they've tried it. And we've all done it. We've all took that little chance of, always it's a cup final or it's a perceived big game or the player wanted to give it a go and it didn't work out for them. I think ultimately, you've got a bit of a crash net ready for them when they fall and then wrap them up again and go, right, we're going to start again. Because ultimately, my job is a motivator. If I sit there and go, I told you so, Derek, we'll get better again. But ultimately, it's bigger than me. It's nice to have a right one. But I like being wrong when it happens. I like to be wrong. I like it to be a play that works out really well for them. And I'm the one who's in the wrong. I like that one better. It's not often though, David, to be honest with you. I'm not often wrong.
Lads, have you had it? John?
Sorry, I can't recall in the last few seasons having it. I think, it's like I think Stephen said, it summed it up quite well. I mean, there's a lot of emphasis going to be on the players themselves as well. I mean, we are there to provide advice and guidance. And if they choose on occasions to go against that guidance and it doesn't go well, I'm like Ali, I'm not a told you so person, but I do like to give, my boys the opportunity to say, listen to what I've got to say and then make their informed decision. And, knowing full well that in 99% of cases, it's going to potentially get worse. But I fortunately haven't had that recently.
Stephen?
I think it's just risk reward at the end of the day. He's just there informing, having, it's almost like informed consent where this is what could happen. This is the downsides if it goes pear-shaped. And then who makes the final call? I think there's times where you would step in and say, listen, absolutely no chance, not playing. And then there's other times where you're asking the player, what do you think? What do you want to do? It's on your toes. There's a couple of I think it's, to be honest, I don't think now managers really want to push players to play if they don't want to play or if they're not right. I think managers from my point of view, I think they're more cautious now than they've maybe ever been. Maybe that's kind of education with injuries and seeing things on Sky and stuff like that. Like they're kind of a little bit more informed. I don't think they really want to take a risk. I think obviously as well, a lot of, I don't know, the managers now are generally, it's total generalisation, but I think the coaches now and the managers now are younger and they've probably been around, like my manager our gaffer at Morpeth, he's only 31, or he might only be 30. He's played in the Premier League. He's been around a professional setup, and he's had two ACLs himself. So he understands completely a rehabilitation process. He understands the psychology of what an injured football is going like. So he would never push somebody to play if they're not right. So yeah, I think it just depends on the kind of the support network you've got around you, really.
No, I completely agree. I think I've noticed that managers now are a lot better with it than they used to be. My gaffers are both quite close in age and have both played professionally, and they have the same input. They've been injured, they know what it's like, take as much time as you need. So I think it's definitely a changing, for me anyway, personally, a changing viewpoint from managers and gaffers, personally. And players, I think players are more aware as well now about what injuries are and what can happen. I think a lot of the younger ones are really well informed about their injuries and what can happen. And Google always helps, isn't it? Dr. Google.
I mean, one last question before we finish tonight, and it's a question for everybody, and I'd be very interested as well to know this one as well. I mean, is what with the job that you do inside football, what is your biggest love, and what is your sort of your biggest hate about the job that you have to do, John?
I suppose that. Biggest love is that when you're on a decent run, the boys, there's a real buzz in the dressing room, and you know, people are all sort of in high spirits, and you know, that general togetherness. Hate, apart from losing, obviously, because everyone hates losing, but you know, when the boys will start finger pointing at a particular event that's happened in a game that's caused a pattern of play to go, you know, adversely for us. But I think in the main, I think all four of us probably do it just because we all love football. But yeah, that's me, quite simple.
Mm-hmm. Ali, I mean, within your sort of physio role, I mean, what would you say is the biggest frustration? Maybe, I know sometimes you talk about people not getting paid, etc. But what is your loves and hates?
I think my greatest love, when you get a player you've worked with for a long time, whether that's sort of well-being wise or injury wise, and then they flourish. So I had a young lad who I had a good sort of a couple of years ago now, where a bit down the dumps, had a really good long chat with him, and then his performance just picked up just because he felt better in himself. And it was lovely to watch a young man just flourish and grow and be the best that he could be, and then he moves on. But I love seeing players flourish and grow. Probably my favourite thing to watch. My greatest hate. It's probably, if I'm being really, really non-serious about it, probably the car parks. I've got a new car and they're horrible, and I'm going to get a dent in it soon. That, and using my expensive tape on their socks. They always pick up my most expensive zinc oxide and wrap it around there. These guys, I hate it. It does my head in. Just stop using my expensive tape on your socks. It's the same colour. You've got to take it off anyway.
Hannah?
When it's away day and I have to pick up a couple of players and it's a very long trip and they're already late.
And they're asleep on the way home, isn't it, Hannah? Always asleep on the way home.
Or grumpy. Yeah. Some of our results recently, they're grumpy on the way home.
What's your greatest love then, Hannah?
I love the game. I literally love the game. Win, lose, draw. I mean, obviously everyone loves a win, but honestly, I've wanted to be back in football for so long. I love it. Mm. Come back and make sure I watch all the highlights of all the games that have been. I could watch any game. Doesn't matter. I just love football.
And I think anybody actually seen it, like first time we've met tonight, and it's over sort of Zoom. I think just hearing you talk, you can see how much you love the game. And how passionate you are about the job that you do at Tower Hamlets, and how much you actually do love the game.
I've got to say, they're a very lucky club have Tower Hamlets to have you. I'll tell you that much. They will be counting their lucky stars that they've got you in there, mate. Honestly,
I think they know it because I'm constantly getting messages from them. Oh, Han, I need this. Oh, Han, da 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 da. But football has just been my game since I was young. Like my dad played football. And, you know, I used it as a bit of an intel to have a better relationship with him. Mm-hmm. But turned out the best thing for me. So, yeah, no regrets. That's literally my biggest love. It's the best thing that I could ask for. I can't wait for our next game.
And every time you say, when I was young, I think to myself, gee whiz. I just wish I was your age now. I don't know about being young. Anyway, Stephen?
I love injured players coming back and playing, doing well. I love academy lads or young lads that I've worked with as kids and then they've come through the team, get a bit emotional at times with them. I'm probably a little bit too protective of those lads. But I think the biggest thing is just being part of the team. If I look at my whole friendship group, it's literally my whole friendship group, my girlfriend, everyone I kind of know and speak to has come from either playing football or being involved in football. I'd have to sit and reflect to think that, but pretty much everyone I know is through football. They're the relationships that I've had, and I just know so many people, and it's through football. I think the things that I hate is just, I think the biggest one is seeing teams at a decent level who their players don't get looked after properly in terms of they get a long-term injury and you see them potentially having, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with the NHS, I'm the biggest advocate, but when you're paying players a fortune and then they're having to do GoFundMe pages to pay for somebody's surgery, or they're having to wait 6 weeks for a scan because someone won't pay 300 quid, that does my nut in, especially, you know, like I say, when you've got players on decent money. I think when clubs are negotiating contracts with players, they should be putting 20 quid a month aside out of their wages to go towards private healthcare and stuff like that to make sure if somebody needs a scan, get a scan. Someone needs a consultation, get a consultation, because you see players where they're losing 6 months of their career just because they're having to sit on a waiting list, and I don't think that's good enough for some levels of the game, and that's probably my biggest bugbear.
That's a great point as well. What a great point to finish on. But I suppose if my loves of it, I suppose my loves is talking to amazing people like yourselves week in, week out, and whenever I can, and doing as much as I probably can for non-league football by doing this sort of programmes, if it's for the Isthmian League or the Southern League, or just doing it just to promote people, wonderful people like yourselves, then that's what I love. And I suppose my only hate with it always the fact that I can't do it as a full-time job, because that's what I'd like to be able to do, and be able to do it and actually get paid for actually promoting everything that's non-league football. Because when we've got people like yourselves and, of course, all the other physios and therapists around who are absolutely fantastic people, it's you guys need to be promoted as much as you possibly can.
Can I be mildly cheated? I've just got to say how proud I am to be a physio today with the people that are around me on this group. It's just amazing to hear from such passionate, professional and all-round amazing therapists. So thank you guys. I think we don't pick ourselves up enough, but thank you for being involved in the league. It's honestly amazing to talk to you all properly.
and I echo that as well, but I think this has probably been one of the best programs we've done in a very, very, very long time. We've four very, very passionate people about the job that they do, and I really do appreciate you guys giving up your very valuable free time to come on and join us, and I only hope that you might come back and join us, of course, later on in the season, maybe just after the end of the season, and have another chat with us as well, because that would be fantastic.
Hopefully on the physio podcast I'm meant to be doing for next season, David.
Well, yes. Yeah. I was going to say that once we came off air, just in case you didn't want me to say it. But that would be fantastic.
I'm working on it.
That would be fantastic. But next week, we're back next week. Now, the guest I've got next week, I really needed help with. But of course, it's a young lady's birthday next week. So happy birthday, young lady.
Thank you.
For next week. So she won't
21
be
again.
She won't be able to be with me next week. Keith won't be able with me next week. Oh my days, what have I let myself in for? Next week, joining us next week, young Ems is going to make her return, and she's coming on. She is, of course, the Cray Wanderers physiotherapist. She will be joining me next week for a very serious subject, in all fairness, and she has been going through it over the last few weeks, and probably a little bit longer than that in all fairness, with her issues with her medical issues. I won't say exactly what they are. I'll let her explain that next week, what they are. If you follow her on Twitter, you'll know exactly what they are. She's going to come on and have a good chat with us about that. We're going to try and get a few, maybe if we try and dig around, see if we can find some specialists, and the guys here might be able to help me once we go off air in a minute, to join us next week. And then the following week, we're actually going to have the guys from Metropolitan Police FC will be joining us, Gavin McPherson and the guys from down there, because they were going to hold the show right over to them. They've got a few things that they want to tell us about the club and promote their club, which is what we're here for. So, of course, the week after, we'll be joined by the Metropolitan Police FC. So they will join us in 2 weeks' time. But it'll be a great show next week. I know you're going to have to suffer from me, and the beauty won't be here. It'll only be Ems holding the show up, not me. But, of course, who knows? It could turn into the effing bag show quite quickly next week, but we shall see. But
you're not missing one, Ree. I'm sure you'll get around.
But a massive thank you for watching us all tonight, and join us next week, of course, with the fabulous Ems next week. And thank you, guys, for joining us. And, of course, also thank you for you guys at home for watching. Good night.
Thank you.